Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Saturday, June 4th, 2016. It's just after 20 UTC as I'm starting to record here. You'll notice that's much later in the week than we usually do this. We try to always do one episode per Sunday through Saturday week, and we've never missed that in years now. In fact, this is our anniversary episode. I'll try to look up exactly how many years it is. I think it's been 8. I don't know. Anyway, I'll look that up in a break. Anyway, so what happened, and I'm by myself. This is Sam Minter, and Yvonne Bo is not here with me. When we went at our regular time to record this week, it turned out Yvonne was sick, and his whole family was sick, and he was just towards the end of it, he hoped, but his family was just starting it, and so he expected he'd have to miss not be able to do it anytime this week. I put out a call to the volunteers who have either co-hosted the show in the past or who have said that they might be willing to. I only got one response, and that was a response saying, sorry, can't do it this week. None of the others responded. Hey, guys, you are slacking. You are slacking. Nobody responded to me. Except the one person. I thank you very much for saying you couldn't do it. But the rest of you guys didn't even answer my email. Tisk, tisk, tisk. What that means is I am doing a solo show, sorta, but not really. While not a co-host, Michael, who I interviewed a couple weeks ago, heard Yvonne's response to his interview from last week, where Yvonne basically was like, I don't even understand what he's saying, as sort of, Michael's sort of, had said, you know, he's a gay Republican and he doesn't think the Republican Party is hostile to gays anymore, et cetera, et cetera. And Yvonne expressed some incredulity. Anyway, Michael wanted to come on and respond to that. So I did record an interview with him, allowing him a chance to respond to that and also talk more generally about gay Republicans and what's going on with that sort of community and how he feels that sort of plays out. I'm going to save that to last. And in the meantime, we'll do just me talking a little bit about some of the things that are going on. After this initial segment, where I tell you what I'm going to do the rest of the show, basically three other segments. We're going to have one segment on, you know, Trump stuff, all of the Trump news that's been going on in the last week or so, a little more than a week, actually. Then we're going to have a second segment on other election stuff that's going on. Then a third segment of just a couple other random things I wanted to mention or talk about. And then finally, we'll close it out with Michael's interview, sort of follow-up interview, rebuttal to Yvonne, whatever you want to call it. And that'll be a show. So I'm going to go and drop it into a break, and we will be right back after this to talk about the Trump stuff. Oh, and I'll find out exactly how many years it's been we've been doing this show. Back after this.
This is Sam here with an opportunity for you. Yes, you heard me right, an opportunity. For you loyal listeners of Curmudgeon's Corner, you know, every once in a while, Yvonne can't make a show. And I do a solo show, which, you know, I think I do okay. But, you know, it's always interesting to have a second person to bounce off. And just in general, sometimes it's good to hear another voice. If you, yes, you, have some things to say about the kinds of things we usually talk about on Curmudgeon's Corner, you know, politics, current events, news, tech, then drop me a line at abelsmay@abelsmay.com letting me know. And hey, I'll keep you in mind and maybe ask if you can join us sometime, either on a regular show with Yvonne if it's something particularly pressing that you maybe have an expertise on, or just, you know, hey, an opportunity to co-host when Yvonne is out. Who knows? Now, I am not guaranteeing that if you send me an email, you will definitely get on the show, but let me know if you're interested, and I'll keep you in mind. Thanks, and now, back to the show.
Okay, I'm back. So first of all, I usually select those breaks randomly. I have 10 I choose from, and I use a random number generator to pick them and insert them after I've recorded everything. But this time, since I'm recording straight through, I actually picked, and you know which one I picked? I picked the one about volunteering to be a possible co-host, because as you see, I'm doing a solo show, and because, you know, my current stable of co-hosts, nobody was available this week, apparently. And I have right now, I have 7 people on that volunteer list. Obviously, I need some more. So if you are at all interested in sometimes working on this show, co-hosting, send me an email. Like I said in the little break, just because you email me doesn't guarantee it'll work out. We have to sort of see if we've got some chemistry talking and see how that goes. And we have to, you know, sort of somehow, yeah, basically be in line with the kind of things I want to be doing. You know, drop me a line if you're interested, and I will put you on that list. Anyway, and you can contact me the way it said in the thing, or email feedback@curmudgeons-corner.com, which I set up sometime after I put that thing together. Anyway, and on the anniversary, the first, Yvonne and I, of course, did this show on college radio, on WRCT radio in Pittsburgh, back in the early 90s. And we probably did, I don't know, on order of 50 episodes back then. But then we restarted it as a podcast on June 3rd, 2007. This will be our 463rd episode since then. We've done one every week since then. And if you do the math, of course, June 3rd, 2007, as of when I'm recording this, that was 9 years ago yesterday. So we have been doing this show, Yvonne and I, for 9 years. We do it mostly, obviously, for fun and because we enjoy it. The listenership is not huge. We appreciate every single one of you who are listening. We've had some loyal listeners who've gone back all the way to 2007, and we really appreciate you guys. Over the last year or so, I've been doing a little bit of Facebook advertising, and we've gotten some new listeners from that. So we really appreciate you as well, anybody who's joined us recently. It's fun to do the show just to do the show, but it's really great when we get interactions from our listeners and people commenting on our Facebook page or emailing us or otherwise interacting with us. We love to hear from you. We love to know that there are people listening and being hopefully entertained by this show. Maybe you learn something too sometimes, but I wouldn't count on that. Yvonne and I are both, you know, we're both amateurs. You know, we're not experts in the field. We're not professional pundits. We have day jobs. We have fun, and hopefully you do too if you're listening to this. Anyway, 9 years. 9 years is a long time to be doing this kind of thing. And for anybody who has any doubts, this is a money loser. This is not something that we do to get income or anything like that. It's purely, as they say, a labor of love. Anyway, back to the actual agenda of the show. Time to talk about Donald Trump for a little while. First of all, as anybody who's paying attention knows, he clinched the Republican nomination in terms of the projected delegate count. So it was kind of expected that that would happen this coming week with the contest on June 7th. Trump went ahead and rounded up a few of the remaining uncommitted delegates. There were enough uncommitted delegates to put him over the edge. And, for a long time, they just sort of been sitting there, you know, with no one knowing exactly what they're going to do and no one seemingly doing a specific effort to go out and contact them and figure it out. But AP did exactly that. AP went out and made the phone calls and contacted a whole bunch of them. And I guess the Trump campaign probably did too. They had a final event in North Dakota with the delegates that sort of pushed him over the edge. By most counts, including my own. Absent something catastrophic, Trump's it. I mean, that's honestly been the case for a little while now. But he's officially over the number now. There we go. What else is there to say about that? Not much. I do want to do a little bit of retrospective in that I feel the one thing I have to apologize for in my election coverage is I, like a bunch of other people, sort of for a while in March and April, got a little overexcited about the possibility of a brokered convention. It was still a live possibility. At one point, I estimated as high as 60%. I think that's where I was getting a little overenthusiastic. Looking at Sam Wang and others who did numerical simulations based on real data as opposed to just a gut feel, the odds never got much more above 30%. 30-35% was really as high as you got in terms of the odds of a contested convention. Now, 35% is nothing to sneeze at. It's... yeah, it's certainly a real possibility, but I think, yeah, when I gave my beginning of the year predictions on our prediction show, one of the things I said was that it would be incredibly hard for any opponents to continue to contest when it became clear that he was so much in the lead, and I think that's exactly what you saw happen. I mean. Bottom line is Kasich and Cruz folded completely. And Cruz folded almost exactly within a week of the time that he became mathematically eliminated. That noise you hear is my son Alex, who has also been a regular participant on Curmudgeon's Corner since he was born 6.5 years ago. Yeah, there he is. So, okay, I'll be right back once I detach my spawn from myself. Oh, there you go. Bye, Alex. We'll see you in a little bit. He smiled. Okay. Anyway, what was I saying? Yeah. Yeah, 30% is nothing to sneeze at. It is a real possibility. However, it was almost always Trump's to lose. If you had to bet on it, you would have bet on Trump all the way along, not on the contested convention.
Don't stop it.
Okay, say what you need to say real quick. And if you yell, you're done.
No, I'm not. Okay, so...
Not so close. No, no, no.
Okay, okay, so we're going to represent Wolf.ei, known as... So, say that, Dad.
Wolf.ei.
Is its real name.
Oh, okay. Okay.
He's a wolf.
I'm a wolf. Okay.
No, he's a wolf.
He's a wolf.
Not you're a wolf. Not I'm a wolf.
Okay, bye.
Not Dad's a wolf.
Gotcha.
Not Mom's a wolf.
Bye.
Not sisters are wolves. Not grandmas are wolves. Not grandpas are wolves. Not anything is a wolf except that special wolf.
Right.
Or those wolves.
Okay.
Or more wolves.
Okay, bye.
Oh, more wolves. No,
I'm okay. Anyway, you get my point. And Trump's it now, and the capitulation we've seen ever since it became, since everybody else dropped off, has just accelerated. Paul Ryan officially endorsed Trump this week. And maybe there were private assurances or something, but at least publicly, there was absolutely nothing. Trump, Ryan had said, he wanted to, I don't know what Ryan wanted. He said he wasn't where Trump was a couple weeks ago. Now he is. It certainly doesn't appear like he got anything from Trump in exchange, any sort of commitments about how he would behave. I mean, even since that endorsement. He's been done a number of embarrassing things, or anything on policy. I mean, maybe behind the scenes, Trump said, I'll support that item, that item, that item from your agenda. But nothing we can directly point to. And that's just across the whole Republican Party. It's every, you know, that never Trump is completely and totally 100% dead, with one exception we'll talk about later, which is not really, you know, we'll talk about the David French thing later. But there we go. Now, meanwhile, I said Trump went ahead and did some embarrassing things. The number one thing on the list is he's been going off against this judge who is trying his Trump University case. Now, there are a number of interesting things here. First of all, the Trump University case itself, the more that comes out for that, and a new batch of documents was released from it this week as well, the more it becomes clear, it absolutely, totally, 100% was a scam intended to get money out of people by giving them absolutely nothing worthwhile in return. Which is okay, I guess. That's the model. But that doesn't look great for Trump. But he's going off on the judge for being unfair because he's Mexican. Of course, the judge isn't Mexican. The judge was born in Indiana. The judge has Mexican heritage. At least one of his parents, maybe two, I forget, was born in Mexico and immigrated to the United States. But, you know, one of Trump's parents wasn't born in the United States either, as far as I know. And, of course, his wives have not been American-born either. But somehow, to Trump, the judge is unfair and can't do a good job because he's quote-unquote Mexican, and he's doubled and tripled down on this. And Trump explains it by, you know, the judge may not be Mexican, but he's proud of his Mexican heritage. And I've seen people try to defend this by saying, well, people all along have been saying that Hispanics don't love Trump and don't like Trump. And so when Trump says it, why is it suddenly bad? But it's not saying this judge wouldn't vote for Trump. It's not saying this judge wouldn't support Trump's positions. It's saying this judge is incapable of being fair because he has Mexican heritage. And even aside from this sort of, and I've also seen people defend it, like some people have said, look how racist Trump is. And then some of his defenders, the best defense they can come up with is Mexican isn't a race. Okay. That, yes. I mean, races aren't really quote unquote real either. Whatever. Okay. Maybe racism is the wrong word. Maybe we should say xenophobic. Maybe we should say nativist. Maybe we should... I don't know what the right word is. Whatever it is, he's a bigot. You know, we can't start, like, normalizing that and saying, hey, this is okay, or excusing it and saying, ha-ha, look at him, he's being funny. No, this is bad, inexcusable behavior, and that's just when you come for the fact that he's doing this crazy Mexican thing to somebody, you know, who's a well-respected... First of all, he's an American citizen. He was born in Indiana. But he's very well-respected. He was approved by the Congress nearly unanimously, if not unanimously. He's got a well-respected record, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He apparently at one point was targeted by Mexican drug cartels, actually, because some of the some of the work he did as a prosecutor earlier. So this is sort of on its face ridiculous what Trump is saying. But beyond that, even if you put all that aside, you've got a presidential candidate who's involved in this kind of lawsuit in the first place, which, you know, is kind of, and you can say, okay, well, Hillary is involved in the email stuff too. Whatever. Okay, yes, that's true. But you've got this sort of, this base accusation, which if it's true, is not a positive thing for Donald Trump. But second, let's even assume Trump is right, and these are trumped up charges, and he's completely innocent, and these cases are meritless, whatever. You've got a presidential candidate talking about an ongoing case sort of blithely without concern about it. You know, one of the typical things you see with almost any politician, and sometimes it's frustrating, is if when they're asked about an ongoing case on something, they'll say, you know, I can't comment on that. That's an ongoing case. It's going to play out in court. Well, that's kind of the responsible way to react to it. Not ranting and raving about the judge, which also, by the way, it just seems time and time again that to Trump, the word unfair simply means not going my way. I don't know. It's frustrating. Of course, he followed that up. Later that day, he was at a rally. And he was talking about a previous rally where there'd been a black Trump supporter. And he was talking about that. And then he sees in the crowd a black guy in his current rally, and he points at him and says, "Hi, look at my African American right there." And so, first of all, he says, "You know, no ill will was intended. He wasn't like doing the quote unquote my as a possessive, like hearkening back to slavery or something." And honestly, I think that's perfectly fair. The people who are putting that interpretation on it, I think, are going a bit overboard. He wasn't trying to make that implication, and maybe he was sloppy with language. The more telling factor here is not Trump's clumsy language. It's the fact that one African American in his crowd is significant and worth pointing out. In two rallies, he apparently had two that he thought were worth mentioning. Like, look, I have a black supporter. Really? Really? It's, you know, I know there are thoughtful people out there who support Donald Trump because they really believe Hillary Clinton is so awful that Trump is better. But I have a really hard time seeing it. I every time the guy opens his mouth, he shows how awful a person he is. And really, you know, nationwide polls, yes, they have Hillary leading, but they have, you know, almost as many people saying, yeah, I'll vote for him. Let's see, what are the latest numbers? I'm looking at pollsters' average right now. 42% Clinton to 38% Trump. So 38% of the American public right now says, yay, Trump. Now, maybe I'm being a bit blithe there. No, they're not necessarily saying, yay, Trump. They're saying, in a Clinton versus Trump battle, in which case I may hate both of them, I'll pick Trump. But oh my God, come on. It's we have months of this left. And Trump is just embarrassing himself further. And you know, I speak sometimes about the polarization in society and how the two sides can't even understand where each other are coming from. And usually I try really hard to understand where the other side is coming from. But I tell you, I am having a really, really difficult time really understanding how anybody can look at Trump and say, I can vote for this man. Even with Clinton as the opponent. And I admit, I don't like Clinton either, but every time Trump opens his mouth, Clinton looks better to me. I don't know. Anyway, the other two things on Trump before we move on to the next segment. Veterans, they had this whole thing where Trump a while ago when he skipped that Fox debate said he was doing it to attend a fundraiser for veterans instead. And it turns out he didn't actually give any money to veterans until the press started hounding him about whatever happened to that money. Whatever happened to that money? Did you give that money? He raised about $5.2 million in the end. Most of it was money he raised from other sources. In the end, he threw in about $1 million of his own money. But again, not until, he was really pinned down about it. I guess he was hoping people would forget about it, and he didn't really intend to ever give money. Once again, another, Trump is a slime ball kind of thing. The flip side of that, though, and this should not go without mentioning, is there have, over the last couple weeks, and just in the last few days, there have been a couple notable examples. There have been more and more cases of anti-Trump protesters getting violent. And one, I'll stipulate to this, because it's true, generally speaking, whenever these kinds of things happen, the vast majority of protesters probably intend to be completely peaceful and not engage in this kind of behavior. And it's usually a handful of instigators. However, there have been those handful of instigators. They've smashed windows on police cars. They threw an egg at a woman in this latest one. They've been physically intimidating people. They've been doing other things along these lines. And two things to say about that. First is utterly unacceptable behavior, almost no matter what. I get that Trump is odious. I get that Trump is one of the worst people you can imagine. But it is a core central value, at least I would hope that it is, of American life.
Get crazy, Quack.
Thank you, Alex. It is a core central value of an American life that people should be able to express their views, they should be able to have political assemblies, they should be able to discuss things politically and do so without interference. And I'm not talking First Amendment here. First Amendment is just the government. I'm talking as a more general principle that it is important to hear the other side. It is important to let the other side plan and congregate and figure out what they're doing, even if you're not listening to them. It's important to let them have those activities. It's important, and I think it is critically important to listen to them as well. And there's this increasing tendency to try to shut up the other side or try to paint the other side as not just someone in honest disagreement about what to do, but someone so evil that they don't even deserve to be heard, that having them heard is in and of itself dangerous. And I think that is a very negative trend, and specifically in the case of violence. Now, I've heard some people defend this as, if you really think Trump is the next Hitler, shouldn't you be doing everything possible to stop him, including violence? That's a tough argument, but I think the answer is violence shouldn't be on the table unless there really are no other options. And we've got plenty of other options right now. Violence shouldn't be on the table unless there are no other options, and he's actually proven himself. We can speculate all we want that, Trump will disrespect the rule of law and do this and that, but you know, first of all, chances are he's not actually going to be in, like, another Hitler. More like he could be a Berlusconi or somebody like that, which is bad enough. Or in his worst possible dreams, maybe a Mussolini, but and probably not. But, you know, we shouldn't even be thinking about violence unless it really did already escalate that to that level. Not just in speculation, but he'd actually proven it. And even then, only as an absolute last resort. And I don't think we're, well, even in my worst imagination, I don't honestly feel that we're getting to that point. But right now, certainly not. If you think Trump is bad, you want to defeat him in the election. And if that is your goal, a protester going and becoming violent is not helping that goal. In fact, it's quite possibly going the other way, because it allows Trump to then, on his next speeches, go talk about the thugs that are doing violence in the street and how you need somebody like him to defend against them. To all the people who are already thinking that, you know, look at these liberal nut jobs and blah, 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 you feed right into that. And if anything, you solidify Trump's support with that kind of behavior. There's no place for that in a quote-unquote civilized society, which I hope ours is. And so I don't like Trump. I think anti-Trump protesters are, generally speaking, fine. But if they cross that line into violence, if they cross the line into intimidation, if they cross the line into trying to shut up the Trump people and the Trump supporters, they've gone beyond the pale, and they need to be rejected outright by everybody. At least that's where I am. Okay, enough Trump. Let's take a break, and then we'll be back after this.
Facebook, Facebook, Facebook!
Hey, do you want to help support Curmudgeon's Corner? Well, right now, the best way is through Facebook. If you haven't already liked us on Facebook, and you actually, well, like us, then go search for Curmudgeon's Corner on Facebook and like our page. It will help you see when we announce new episodes, and it'll help us reach more new people, too. If you like a particular episode, like our episode announcement post too, or share it with your friends. All of this helps spread the word about our podcast to more people who might like it as well. And of course, we love having a conversation with all of you listeners, so please use Facebook to leave comments on the shows, give us suggestions, or anything else like that. It's always great to hear from you. So if you want to help the show, use Facebook. Or forget all of that and just send us money.
Okay, we are back. And so time to talk about some election 2016 stuff that is not about Donald Trump. First of all, on Clinton Sanders, we talked last week about what does he want at this point and all of that kind of stuff. Right now, the only real question that's left is when does he give up? Does he really take it all the way to the convention? Or does he call it quits essentially after the June 7th results? We're already at the point, as of when I'm recording this on Saturday, June 4th, where if enough of the remaining superdelegates who hadn't yet given a preference came out for Clinton, they could put her over the top right now. But Clinton obviously doesn't want that, so I wouldn't be surprised if she's actually out there telling the remaining superdelegates who haven't already said one way or another, please wait, because she would rather not be put over the top by superdelegates. Donald Trump didn't care one bit that he was put over the top by uncommitted delegates, because there was no longer really a contest at that point. On the Democratic side, there obviously is. She would much rather be put over the top by the results of actual voting. But the superdelegates could put her at the top at any moment, essentially. And almost certainly at the latest, that will happen by June 7th. She only needs 10% or so of the remaining delegates in order to clinch the nomination. By my count, she actually needs 9.74% of the delegates. She's got 2,293, and there she needs 2,383. Several news organizations actually give her on the order of 20 more delegates than I have because of internal numbers they have where they've contacted specific superdelegates and asked them, and they've given them assurances privately that aren't someplace that I can verify. So anyway, she's very, very close. And Sanders, you keep hearing the Sanders folks saying, well, you shouldn't count the superdelegates. They don't get to vote until the convention, blah, 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 blah. And it baffles me. It's just self-delusion at this point. I mean, yes, the superdelegates can change their mind up until the very last moment. Yes, you may disagree that superdelegates should exist, but they do, and they've stated their preference. At least a lot of them have, enough have, and if they're going to change their minds, they have to be... What plausible case are you going to make here that they're going to, that they want to? Now, if we get past June 7th and, you know, all the estimates have Clinton having clinched the nomination, yes, because it is superdelegates that put her over the edge, or because there are enough superdelegates that without them she wouldn't win, let's put it that way, you could have an all-out effort to change their minds. But is Sanders really going to spend the next month trying to convince superdelegates to please, please change your mind? You said you're for Clinton. Clinton has won the popular vote. Clinton has won the pledge delegates. Clinton has won this. Clinton has won that. Clinton has won that. But we still think you should overturn all of those results by voting another way. Now, I use the word overturn. I think it's completely legitimate that superdelegates could do that if they felt like it. But that is Sanders' argument. And it's contrary to his argument in the early part of the race. It's just so hypocritical. It's like picking whichever argument is best for you without any logical consistency in terms of, well, do you believe superdelegates are good? Do you believe they're bad? If there weren't any superdelegates, Clinton would win anyway. If all of the primaries were open, Clinton would have still won. You know, there are all of these arguments. Look, bottom line is Clinton has won this process, and the Sanders folks have to kind of get over it at this point. If they want to go through the process to try to argue for changes in the process for 2020, great, awesome, do that. There are a number of proposals. You could eliminate superdelegates entirely. You could make it so superdelegates have half a vote instead of a whole vote. You could say that, eliminate caucuses. That would have hurt Sanders, by the way, but they're very undemocratic. There are all kinds of things you could do to reform this process. Argue for those. It's not, but it's just the height of denial to spend after Clinton passes the magic number, including superdelegates, assuming she's over it by a decent amount, the notion that Sanders is going to change the minds of those superdelegates is just nuts. Again, as always, absent a major implosion. You know, if Hillary has a major health crisis, if Hillary does get indicted, and by something serious enough that most Democrats agree it's a fair indictment, these kinds of things could change things. So nothing against Sanders sort of not, like, releasing his delegates to Clinton or anything. I'm not suggesting that. He can stay in this. There's no reason not to sort of stay as an active candidate through to the very end. But let's not pretend that he's going to get, you know, all of these Clinton superdelegates to change their mind, or even a significant number of them to change their mind. Where the superdelegates stand right now is They're 523 for Hillary Clinton, 46 for Bernie Sanders, 145 left who have not given any opinion. And there's one that's still listed as Martin O'Malley. Look, maybe you could flip a... I don't know. Like, from everything I've seen, Sanders' efforts to get superdelegates to change their minds have completely and totally failed and perhaps backfired and made people even more beholden to Clinton than before because they think that the Sanders folks trying to get them to change their minds are annoying. Anyway, we'll see what Sanders does over the next month and how much chaos he causes or not. Next up to mention is the Libertarian Convention. Last weekend on May 26th to May 30th was the Libertarian National Convention. And in the end, the expected winners won. Gary Johnson for president and William Weld for vice president. It took multiple ballots. Hey, we got our contested convention. Woo! So both the presidential and vice presidential elections at the convention took two ballots to get there. But, you know, there are a couple things here. First of all, I've mentioned before on the show, I'm tempted by Gary Johnson. He seems to be the kind of libertarian that I'm always wished the libertarians would run. Meaning he's got actual governmental experience. He's been a governor, so has his vice presidential candidate, William Weld. He is socially liberal and not shy about that. And he's got some of the sort of economic conservative, fiscally conservative stuff I kind of like in certain circumstances. He's, in general, more moderate than a lot of libertarians tend to be. He still says a few things that I think are a bit too rash, like how quickly he would balance the budget, get rid of the debt, things like that. I think he advocates doing it in a way that is too sudden and too fast and would cause a lot of pain, things like that. But he's tempting because he has directionally... Like, he's got the anti-war stuff that I like from, Rand Paul. He's got the socially liberal positions that I like from the Democrats in general. So he almost seems like almost where I would want to be. Like, there are a few areas where he's... Like I said, he's a little bit too extreme for me, but he's closer than libertarian candidates tend to be. He's closer to the mainstream than they tend to be. When I end up deciding in 2016, come November, how I'm going to vote, my choice is between Hillary Clinton and Gary Johnson. Donald Trump doesn't even enter into the equation. He is not an option for me. I think I've made that clear. And I'm not really seriously considering, the Green candidate or anybody like that. Jill Stein is the presumptive nominee there, although it won't be official till August. I'll have to look a lot closely at Johnson and a lot more closely at Clinton. I suspect that my personal views are closer to Johnson than Clinton. So I want to take them seriously and pay attention to this. And I encourage everybody to actually pay attention to these third parties and see what they have to say, because they may well represent you better than the Republicans or Democrats do. Having said that, let's talk about the Libertarian Convention for a little bit. And there was a lot of craziness there. And it exposed how the Libertarian Party as an organization, even though they ended up nominating Johnson and Weld, have a reputation for being nut jobs and probably deserve it. So, first of all, let's talk about the two main opponents. There were more. There were, like, let me count here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There were 10 candidates who got at least one delegate to vote for them on the first ballot at the Libertarian National Convention. But aside from Gary Johnson, there were two major ones. That was Austin Peterson. And I didn't know much about him and still honestly don't know that much about him. But from what I've seen, he's very socially conservative. And that was a lot of his main attacks on Gary Johnson were that Johnson was too moderate, too liberal on social issues, things along those lines. Basically, everything he attacked about Johnson were the things I liked about Johnson. And then we had John McAfee, who we've mentioned a few times on the show before. He's the guy who, you know, was well known for McAfee antivirus program way back in years past. He was famous for that. But basically, he's a complete nut job. You know, and I'm not even talking about political viewpoints here, but, you know, he got into all kinds of legal issues in Central America. He was a suspect for murder. He's been in trouble with the law in various other places as well. He's an eccentric millionaire at this point. And, you know, I have no problems with the idea of an eccentric millionaire who wants to do crazy things with his money. But there's nothing there to indicate that he would be, you know, he's sort of, I don't know. I want to call him the libertarian Donald Trump, but maybe that's not quite a good analogy, but, I couldn't bring myself to, like, if Peterson or McAfee were the libertarian nominee, they'd be off the table for me, and I'd be 100% Hillary Clinton at this point. But thankfully they lost. But some of the examples of what you saw at the Libertarian Convention. First of all, you know, when Johnson was giving his speeches or when he was debating the other candidates, a couple of the things that came up were, for instance, he was asked if he supported driver's licenses. And he said yes. He thought driver's licenses were a reasonable use of government. And he got booed by the crowd. And look, I understand the theoretical argument about, you know, any sort of licensing or IDs or whatever being government intrusion, blah, blah, blah. But I live in the real world. And I live in a world where I actually do want to make sure that people driving, you know, multi-thousand-pound death machines that could kill people at any moment have some sort of rudimentary level of competence and understand the rules and blah, blah, blah. I kind of think that's actually important. And I don't mind the driver's license. Yes, that kind of thing can be abused. Yes, it has been abused. But come on, this is not an issue in 2016. And only crazy people go around saying, you know, they object to driver's licenses. In another world, if there didn't already exist, maybe I'd have issues. Maybe I'd want to do it in a different form. Maybe I'd want to make sure that, okay, you had some sort of licensing test, but then you had something that you, it wasn't like a huge state database or whatever. I don't know. Or maybe careful limitations on how it's used. I don't know. But come on, let's get real. Driver's licenses is not an issue that people are debating in 2016. Another similar example. Gary Johnson mentioned that he would have supported the civil rights law in 1964. And, you know, look, I've debated on this podcast with Yvonne how, in some cases, I believe that the federal government should not mandate private behavior, even if that private behavior is discriminatory, and how I think there are other better ways to solve those problems. However, this is once again an issue where, first of all, the part that mandated private behavior was only a part of the civil rights law. There are all kinds of other things in there as well. But regardless, this issue was settled decades ago. The American public has decided as a whole that, yes, there is a compelling government interest. There is a compelling societal interest in preventing discrimination, unfair discrimination against certain protected classes, even against completely private affairs. So, yes, if you have a restaurant, you cannot refuse to serve blacks. You cannot seat the blacks in that section and the whites in that section. Not allowed. And any theoretical objections to, you know, yes, I don't think that the business should engage in discrimination, but I don't think it's the government's job to enforce that. Okay, I am actually sympathetic to that argument. But nobody else is. And that debate was settled long ago. And Gary Johnson got booed for being, for approving of legislation that works against unfair racial discrimination. This is how far out significant portions of the Libertarian Party are. I followed on Twitter Peterson and McAfee and a few other libertarian activists in the run-up to the convention, and the number of them that were saying that Johnson was potentially betraying core libertarian beliefs by being more moderate, more liberal, whatever, just really discouraged me about this as an alternative. Because just like when you buy into the Republican Party, you're not just buying the candidate you're talking about. You're sort of buying the organizational ethos of the whole thing. The same thing applies here. Gary Johnson's not going to win. He's not going to be the president, so it doesn't matter. There's not going to be a wave of libertarian senators or representatives either. So some of this is theoretical, but I always worry, okay, even though in the end they ended up nominating Gary Johnson on the second ballot with 55% of the vote on the second ballot, or 55.8, so almost 56%. Just the association with all of these whack jobs also was troubling. There was also a candidate for the chairman of the Libertarian Party who decided that, you know, he was going to strip on stage down to a thong and dance around a little bit. But that's just a sideshow. I guess that could happen anywhere. I'm more worried about the policy type stuff. But I'm excited about Johnson and Weld as sort of a Libertarian Party that has made some concessions to reality and is not, you know, so ideologically pure that, you know, I'm not an ideological purist. I'm a pragmatist. I want to, if something works, I want to go there. Even if it violates some tenet, I generally think that the private sector does better than government at many things. But if you show me the government doing better at something than the private sector does at that same thing, then I'm going to say, oh, well, guess I was wrong on that one. Let's let the government do that one. And so I want some level of pragmatism. And like I said, even though there may be a few areas where they're still more radical than I would like, but I have hope in Johnson and Weld as, you know, look, for one of the very, you know, Johnson was the nominee in 2012 as well. But, you know, we actually have someone who's actually governed a state, who actually has some reasonable positions, and that are an interesting meld of Republican positions in some areas, Democratic positions in others. That sounds good to me. I like that combination. So I'm going to give him a chance, but I did not watch the convention live. I just read reports of it and watched things on Twitter. But every single thing I saw about it was like, Johnston Weld may come out of this with the nomination, but that party is still insane. And we'll see. Anyway, like I said, for November, for my personal vote, it's a two-party race between Johnson and Clinton. And Trump's not in the picture. Stein's not really in the picture. And I will look more carefully at both of them before election time comes. Also, I feel freer in this decision. I've mentioned this on the show before, simply because Washington is not going to be a swing state. It's going to be a blue state, almost certainly. If I lived in a true swing state and my vote had the potential of actually making a difference in November, I wouldn't even consider Johnson. It would be Clinton all the way. Not because I necessarily agreed with her more, but because I wanted to do whatever I could to make sure Trump didn't win. Anyway, one final third party to talk about before we end this segment, and that's David French. And of course, your reaction is, who? He's apparently a columnist for the National Review. The Bill Kristol, who's sort of been one of the people behind the Never Trump movement, has been looking around for a conservative to run as an independent against Clinton and Trump. Apparently, he doesn't like the libertarians. He probably doesn't like Johnson because he's a socially liberal. And who knows what else. But he's decided not to throw himself in with the libertarians. He wants to find another person to run. And apparently, he's been going around to all kinds of people and getting turned down. So, for instance, Mitt Romney won't do it. Kasich won't do it. Basically, apparently, everybody he's asked has said no. And so he found a columnist at the National Review. Apparently, French is considering, but hasn't actually decided. He's never held elective office. Not that that's stopping Trump from running. He was in the Iraq War in the army. I don't know what else there is to even say about him, but the bottom line here is this shows just how empty the Never Trump movement is within sort of the Republicans who are hanging on and still saying Never Trump. They can't find anybody who anybody's heard of. Apparently, even within sort of Republican circles, yeah, he's a columnist in the National Review, but he wasn't a particularly well-known one. I'd never heard of the guy. I'd heard of Bill Kristol. Some people are saying, why don't you just run himself? Why doesn't Bill Kristol just run himself? Look, bottom line, and I said this going back many, many, many months, like to January or February, if not earlier, you can't wait until you have a clear Republican nominee to decide to run as a third party. It's too late. It's too late. If you were going to run someone as a serious independent candidate, we're already past the ballot deadline in Texas and a number of other states, and the others are coming up really fast. It's too late. And even if you wanted to take over one of the other parties, it's too late. The Libertarians and Greens are the only ones that are on a really significant number of state ballots. And it's too late for the Libertarians. I guess there's still a little bit of time for the Greens, but you're going to get a conservative Republican to win the Green nomination? Really? No. Maybe there are ways to try to sneak that through by, getting your people in last minute. But I mean, it happened with the Reform Party a while ago, something like that, where an outsider who wasn't really aligned from the party ended up taking it over because of that kind of stuff. But it's too late. It's too late to run as a third party. And now that they'll say, well, we don't need to have enough electoral votes to win. We just need enough electoral votes to throw it into the House of Representatives. And then the House of Representatives can do something. But the key here is then you have to pick someone who's going to take votes. You can't pick someone who will only take votes away from Trump. Let's put it that way. You need to have someone who will take votes away from Clinton. And you're not going to get that from nominating a conservative. You'll just split the Trump vote and guarantee the Clinton win. If you really wanted to do something that required that threw you into the House of Representatives, you need to run Bernie Sanders. You need to run someone who's going to take votes away from Clinton, and you need to run away someone who's a conservative and make it so nobody has a majority, and you have four candidates and blah blah blah. Even then, the House has to pick from the top three, I believe, the top three electoral vote getters. It becomes very complicated. And anyway, it's too late. And it's just pitiful that you see these last sort of ditch efforts by Crystal or whoever. Who knows? I could be wrong. We could find out that like 2 weeks from now, David French is running independent and has a whole bunch of money behind him. And suddenly people are flocking to him and he's has a real chance of winning electoral votes and blah, blah, blah. But no, I really don't think so. That's not going to happen. David French? Really? I mean, I tweeted, ha 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 ha, who? And that who is the important part. I mean, if Crystal had found a governor or a senator or somebody like that, a former member of the cabinet, a general even, I don't know. I guess this guy was a major in the army. Anything like that, then maybe you at least take it somewhat seriously. If it's someone that you've heard of and people has a reputation, and when people think of them, they go, oh, yeah, they're good. Maybe they're better than Trump. Maybe I should really consider them. That's not going on here. Okay, that's it for election stuff. We'll wrap this up. I'm going to come back with another segment really quick on my other random stuff, which really isn't that much of it. And then we'll jump into Michael from Pennsylvania's additional clarifications on being a gay Republican. Back after this.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
Okay, I'm back. I'll try to make this quick before we move into the next segment Michael thing. So we had that gorilla incident where the kid fell into the gorilla exhibit and they had to kill the gorilla. A number of people asked the question, did they really have to kill the gorilla? You know, it's hard to do the counterfactual. There have been cases where kids have fallen into gorilla enclosures and the gorilla has actually been protective and helped get it back to the humans and hasn't hurt the kid at all and blah, blah, blah. From all reports in this case, the gorilla was treating the kid in a way that the kid was in danger. And more to the point, the gorilla was getting increasingly agitated by the way the crowds were reacting. And it was a very unpredictable situation. And there wasn't enough time for a tranquilizer, etc. Yeah, I'm sorry they killed the gorilla too, but I can't fault the I can't fault the zoo staff too much for it. They made a really hard decision on the fly with limited information, and they had to do it quickly. And I wish they could have come up with a different solution, but it is what it is. I think that the important lessons to learn here are a few things. One, of course, a three-year-old should not be able to get in. You know, there should be enough bars in enough places, narrowly enough spaced, that the three-year-old cannot get in. This is not like, yes, I've been a parent at a zoo, and yes, I've been, I try to watch my kid very carefully, but, you know, it shouldn't be a matter of if you get distracted and lose your way, or the kid gets away from you, you should have a feeling of confidence that they could try really, really hard and still not get in to the exhibits. And so I think there's definitely some questions about the design of the area. I mean, there's also a bigger question of should you be exhibiting gorillas in this way anyway, or other animals, and does being in captivity hurt them in various ways? And there are a lot of very serious issues on that. Zoos have gotten better over the years, I gather, but still there are a lot of issues for animals in zoos, and they're not the best places, most of them anyway. But the one thing that's annoyed me the most about these are the people who come on in a self-righteous way and say, well, it's the parents' fault for not watching their kid. You know, and there was one woman on MSNBC that I happened to see because, she was on right before, my cousin Heather is a foreign policy expert who was on to talk about North Korea and Donald Trump and things like that. But there was this woman on about the zoo right before that who apparently had been the one who started a petition saying the parents should be charged or there should be an investigation or something like that. And she was on there basically saying how she never takes her eyes off her kids, even for a second, and blah, 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 blah. And I am like, you are so full of shit. Come on now. Look, everybody tries to be careful. Everybody tries to look. But there is not a single parent out there who has not at one point or another in a public place suddenly realized their kid wasn't where they thought they were. And has spent at least a few seconds going, oh, crap, where'd they go? And try to deal with that. Now, thankfully, in 99.999% of those cases, the kid is in the next aisle of the grocery store or something, and you find him 5 seconds later, and it's not a big deal, and blah, blah, blah. But to pretend that, you know, could the parents have done something different in this scenario? Maybe. I don't know. Apparently, the parent was distracted by some other kids they had with them for a few seconds and blah, blah, blah. And the woman is saying, you know, as soon as that kid even mentioned that they wanted to go in the gorilla cage, she should have pulled them away from that exhibit and blah, blah, blah. You know, look, it's not a everybody's reasonable expectation is that they're barriers. Even if you let your kid loose, you don't expect them to end up in the gorilla cage or exhibit. It wasn't really a cage. You know, you expect, just like, you know, if you expect that, you know, there are guardrails and things on stairs, so your kid's not going to fall off the stairs. I mean, in some cases, they're not. I have been to a few places where there were, you know, falls big enough to kill somebody that were protected by a guardrail that would not keep a two-year-old from going through it. And when I was near those, I was terrified when I had my kid with me and he was that age, or even for that matter, if I took him now, I was terrified the whole time I was there. And you don't expect that. You expect that people, that there's some level of safety in your environment, especially in a place that's designed for families and children and things like that. And I just got really upset at these people who are blaming the parents for this. There's perhaps some blame to go around, and maybe the parents could have done something better, but it's reasonable to expect that in a facility designed to bring families and children, your two-year-old can't get through and jump into the exhibit with a gorilla. I mean, duh. And I realized they hadn't had this problem in many years, and they whenever. But anyway, like, they're blaming the parents is not the right thing to do here. And then they started bringing up, the father had a criminal record, and then someone brought up, the parents were black, and I'm like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. How are either of those things relevant in any way, shape, or form? Anyway, enough about the gorilla. Another thing that came up this week is hate speech. There was apparently a hashtag trending on Twitter of "I stand with hate speech." And I want to say, like, the people organizing that hashtag and trying to push that, you're idiots. If you actually look into what they were trying to say, I actually kind of agree, and I'll talk about that in a second. But that's not, you don't promote it by saying "I stand with hate speech." Look, the basic concept underneath it is the old quote of, I'm not going to get the exact words right, but I may disagree with you violently and think you are wrong in every single thing you say. I may even think that what you say is like evil. But I will fight to the death for your right to say it. And I mentioned this sort of earlier in the show as well, and I think even in the interview with Michael, it comes up again. But it should be sort of... I agree that as a fundamental principle, it's important that people feel free to express their views, even if they are pernicious, awful views. As other people have said, popular speech doesn't need protection. It's the unpopular speech that needs protection. It's the stuff that 99% of the population thinks is wrong and evil and shouldn't be said. Those are the things that need the protection. And so in that sense, I actually do think hate speech should be protected speech. You should have the right to say bigoted, awful things. You should have the right to say so publicly. You should have... Now, that doesn't mean... And again, this is not First Amendment about the government. It's also about the general environment. And it's very true that you have the right to say that, but you don't have the right for there to be no consequences from it. And I generally agree with that. There, if you say something bad and people don't like you for it and people turn your back on you because of it, that's a legitimate response to you saying something awful. However, there should be certain separations. Like, if I say something that's completely and totally unrelated for my job and doesn't affect my job performance, I shouldn't fear my job because I said something that's politically unpopular. And I certainly shouldn't fear going out in a crowd. And if I'm in a public place, with my little sign saying my unpopular position, whatever that is, I shouldn't fear that somebody's going to beat me up or shut me up or make me leave or anything like that. I should be able to go to the middle of the park and say my hateful thing that I want to say. Now that in no way means that I support those hateful statements, but I think it's important that those people be able to express themselves without fear. Now, of course, as always, there's the time and the place for everything. And if you're being disruptive, that's another story. But sometimes being disruptive is the way to get a message out. So you have to balance that. But I think that's really important. However, and I understand why these people who are I stand with hate speech are sort of trying to say the kinds of things I just said. But I stand with hate speech doesn't leave you with the impression of, you know, I really disagree with these people who are engaging in hate speech, but I believe in their right to do so. I stand with hate speech makes it sound like you agree with the hate speech. You people are idiots. That is not how you promote that view. And I'm also very frustrated in that there's so many places now where it seems like people are trying to shut down and the people with opposing views and keep them from speaking. And now, and I agree, like if you're on a private platform, if you're on Facebook, if you're on Twitter, or if you're whatever, these are private platforms and the owners of those platforms have the 100% right to decide what does or does not belong on their platform. And if they decide a certain type of speech is not allowed, they are fully within their rights. And if you don't like their choice, you go leave and find something else. And that's perfectly legitimate. But in the public space, you know, I just get really frustrated when people, they're not, I mean, even with the Facebooks and Twitters, I don't think shutting down unpopular speech is the right thing to do. It's within their rights, but I don't think it's the right thing to do. But there's a difference between political speech you disagree with and out and out harassment of individuals or people who believe that's a different story. And that crosses another line. But anyway, the people who started that hashtag, I just wanted to, really? That's how you make yourself look like a loon instead of like someone who has a principled position about the value of hearing from people who disagree with you. And it only makes me think you actually agree with the people who are saying the hateful, bigoted things. Okay, one final thing before we move on to the Michael interview. I finished a book. It's been a long time. Well, I've been really bad at finishing books, and most of the books I've finished lately have been audiobooks. But even with audiobooks, the last time I finished an audiobook was in January. But I finished an actual real book where I was actually reading words and instead of listening to it. And it took me over a year to finish this book. And I'm stubborn and I won't start a new book if I'm still reading another book. But the book was Dutch, which was the biography of Ronald Reagan that came out in 1999 by Edmund Morris. It took me, 377 days to finish this book. I started May 18th, 2015, and finished May 28th, 2016. And basically, you can probably tell, like, I was not, like, compelled by this book. And I made myself finish it, but the first half, at least, sort of Reagan pre-presidency, especially pre-governorship, I found were really difficult to get through. It was slow and not compelling, and I had to sort of force myself to read it. And I'd pick up the book and read three pages, and then I wouldn't pick it up again for a week, that kind of thing. And it got better once we got into the presidency, but at that point, I actually felt like it was shorter than it should be. Like, by the time we got to the presidency, it sort of whizzed by really fast and didn't go into enough detail on things that I thought were very interesting, whereas it spent a lot of time earlier on things that I thought were not particularly interesting. But the other thing about this book that was really controversial at the time it came out, which I really didn't like, was Morris made up what he called a fictional narrator for the story. He basically made a fictionalized version of himself as a character in the book that sort of followed Reagan around through his life. I mean, not directly like following 10 feet behind him, walking behind him, but like, you know, was born not that far from him, ran into him in high school, ran into him again in college, and, you know, ended up as being the biographer who was assigned to him while he was at the White House. But he actually spent a lot of time talking about this fictional narrator who was only partially, and I guess he was partially based on the actual author, Edmund Morris, but not really, because he had to be born a couple decades earlier in order to, like, match the timelines. And I think the detailed references of where he was, all that was made up. And, you know, his reasoning for that was really something along the lines of, Reagan was actually pretty boring, and I had to do something like this to create a structure around it to make a compelling narrative through the book. I just didn't think it worked, and was really distracting, and it was annoying. It was annoying. I did not like that. I would have liked better a straight-up biography-type reading. Also, I gather there was some controversy at the time with how Morris portrayed Reagan during the Reagan administration in terms of how tuned in or not he was with various things. Not necessarily that Reagan's Alzheimer's was already a factor during his presidency. Morris actually went out of his way several times in the book to say that he didn't think that was the case. But in various places, he did sort of indicate that, yeah, Reagan was tuned out. And Reagan was paying attention only in a very specific way and wasn't interested in the details and was overwhelmed by certain things. And, you know, I don't know. It does sort of ring true for me, but apparently that was controversial as well. Reagan's life was interesting. I especially like the presidency part I wish was longer and more detailed. And there are some interesting things that happened during the Reagan presidency. I probably even would like to know more about his governorship than was there. But overall, it dragged and wasn't super compelling. I guess if you're really into Reagan, you probably should read it, but there are probably better Reagan biographies out there. This was the quote-unquote authorized one that the Reagan family and Ronald Reagan himself cooperated with during his presidency. Whatever, it was finished. I'm on to another book that hopefully is going faster. That's it. Okay, enough for this. We're going to take a break, and we'll come right back, and we'll do Michael's interview. Back after. It's not really as much as an interview as the one we did a couple weeks ago, but we'll talk to Michael. Back after this.
Hey, we know when you listen to this show, you have thoughts about what we say. You probably want to vent about what we got wrong or what we left out, right? Or maybe you want to suggest some future topics we just haven't gotten to yet. Well then, tell us all about it. Right now, there are 4 ways to get feedback to us. First, you can go to the Curmudgeon's Corner Facebook page and leave comments on the post where we announce all the new episodes. Second, you could go to curmudgeonscorner.com, that's with a hyphen, and leave a comment there instead. Third, both Yvonne and I are on Twitter. You can talk to me at Abulsme, A-B-U-L-S-M-E, or Yvonne at I-M-B-O, I-M-B-O-U. Finally, if you don't want to make your comments in a public forum like that, just email me directly at abulsme@abulsme.com. Again, that's A-B-U-L-S-M-E. But, you know, if you don't want us to mention your feedback on the show, be sure to say so, because otherwise we're probably going to respond to your comments on a future show, because, you know, that's what makes the discussion. Thanks, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Okay, me just again for a second to introduce this. I recorded this about 24 hours, a little under 24 hours before I'm recording the rest of the show. And here you go.
Okay, we have Michael from Pennsylvania back. For those of you who don't remember, he was on a couple weeks ago talking about sort of the experience of the 2016 election cycle from the point of view of a Republican, and specifically from the point of view of a gay Republican. And on last week's show, Yvonne expressed some confusion, I guess, on how that works. He expressed a lot of doubt over you saying that the Republican Party is more friendly to gays than it has been, and sort of those issues you've sort of moved on from them, and your prioritization was, even if there are those issues, the economics are more important. But you also seem to imply it's less of an issue than it used to be, and that was really confusing to him, and it also, frankly, clashes quite a bit with the perception, especially of social conservative Republicans, and acknowledging that there are other types as well. And when you heard Yvonne's comments on that, you messaged me and basically said, hey, I'd like to get a chance to explain a little bit more. So here you go.
Well, I mean, to start with, I reject the entire identity group concept of politics, the entire idea that the Democratic Party has, that we're going to give people these demographic labels, and then we're going to tell them that they're powerless and hopeless, unless they are aided by the Democratic Party to achieve their goals. I think it's actually a really horrible thing to do to any human being, to tell them that, you know, that you can't exceed, you cannot succeed, you cannot really do anything unless, you know, you're some way helped by a Democratic Party to do things, because we don't need political assistance.
Well, I think in this case, the confusion is different than that, per se. It's more the Republican Party, historically, has had a number of positions in their platform and espoused by numerous of their candidates that seem to be fairly hostile to any, you know, to gays specifically, but also in some cases to any lots of other groups. But let's keep the conversation on gays, since that's where you have the experience here. Do you sort of say, is that not true, or does it just not matter, or what's your view on that?
Well, you know, there are no, there's only our political interest. There's no long-term political alliance. I believe that was Bismarck that said that, or was that the German strategy guy? I don't remember, but it's true in politics. You know, during the 80s, you know, gays and feminists were in an alliance, and, you know, I don't know if the feminists had any legitimate goals left by the time of the 80s, but you know, the gays, we clearly did, and, you know, that alliance was helpful. I don't see any benefit in the year 2016 for gay men to be in any type of alliance with feminism, especially now that it's just gone stark raving mad, even if it were like the saner feminism of the 80s, I still don't see any benefit to it.
So you keep giving reasons why sort of not to associate yourself with various liberal causes or the Democratic Party or whatever, but that's very different than saying, what's up with the Republicans? Again,
the Republicans, and, you know, parties are amalgams of interest, and, you know, social conservatives have been important in the Republican Party for quite some time. I guess Reagan really cemented the economic social conservative alliance. And that alliance did fight against gay rights for quite some time, and I guess up to, you know, it was even used by George W. Bush in 2004, you know, that he was kind of banned anti-gay marriage known in the Constitution, which at the time, stood absolutely no chance. It was a, one of those false promises. And, after that, I can't really imagine what someone imagines the Republican Party would do that's negative against the interests of gay people.
So is it basically that, even if you have Republican candidates espousing views that would potentially be harmful to gay people, you essentially say, well, I don't have to worry about that because there's no chance of that actually coming to pass, and so therefore I can worry about their other positions and kind of just ignore that?
Well, I think it's even deeper than that. I mean, like a lot of the issues have moved on and they've changed, and I support, if someone doesn't want to write something in favor of gay marriage on a wedding cake, I think that's their right. I think that to some extent the part of maturation of the gay, which I don't actually maintain has occurred, it doesn't seem to occur in any of these movements, but maturation is just not worrying about, a few people that remain that may disagree with you. You just, it's just not worth your time to worry about. I mean, it's, like right now it seems like, I guess in terms of blacks, they can find, one KKK member somewhere in a state that some way proves that, America is a horrible, racist society. And I'm just like, who cares what one person thinks? Who cares if, there's some weird-ass church out there that's even like the Westboro Baptist Church? It's just not important.
Right, because again, and it seems to come down to, even if somebody has those kinds of views, even if somebody says, I'm not baking a cake, or even if it's, somebody running for Senate or president espousing these views, it seems to come down to you thinking, well, it's not going to matter because the conversation's moved past there and they can't do any real harm. Is that about right?
Well, that's part of it, but I don't even, we have to, and I actively support keeping social conservatives in the Republican Party. I don't want to cast them away. And so, I'm a tolerant person. I can, get along with, reasonable social conservative people. It, means getting Republican senator in who will do what I like about the economy and immigration and issues like that.
Right. Okay, so you had also mentioned to me that you wanted to speak more generally about quote-unquote interesting developments in the gay Republican community or movement, or forget how you put it. And I have no idea what you're referring to, so tell me.
Oh, it's kind of exciting. I mean, like, one of the really big things that's energizing college Republicans these days is, gay issues, and in the positive way. They're really fighting for gay issues. They use gay speakers to attract people to their meetings. So the biggest thing right now on college campuses, what I call the college Republicans, is Milo Yiannopoulos. And, he's, an outrageous gay man, and the college Republicans flock to listen to him. And
so do you think part of this is a generational thing where you can sort of draw a line between younger Republicans and older Republicans, or is there a general movement going on?
Well, I think it's the younger Republicans, but even older Republicans. I mean, if you talk to, I'm currently not in Pennsylvania, I'm in North Carolina, and, if you talk to, even older Republicans in conservative areas, I mean, the area I am in is the area, the district where Mark Meadows comes from. Do you know who Mark Meadows is?
Not off the top of my head.
He was the person who basically got Boehner out of the speakership. He's the man who forced the issue. So we're dealing with a fairly conservative set of Republicans in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're like, you know, we're past that now. We're just going on. I mean, it's... I think that things are conservative.
So do you believe they're past it in terms of they really... personally no longer thinks it's an issue, or do you think they're past it sort of in the sense of we lost that one, let's move on?
Well, it could be both. I mean, some of it's just we lost it, let's move on, let's go fight battles we have a chance on. I mean, but let me ask, going back to
Milo, do you feel like that really is representative of the Republican Party embracing gays as opposed to sort of being, you know, oh, here's our token gay?
I think that the part of his appeal is Milo's transgressive nature. And, you know, I don't know if you're aware of what's happening on college campus these days, but, you know, the left is so intolerant, so humorless, that the Republicans are really looking for someone to be a rebel and you know, kind of fight these people with humor. I actually went to one of Milo's speeches at Pitt, and there were two feminists that were sitting behind me, and you know, I could pick them out. Wasn't very hard, and I turned to them before it started, and I said, you know, I'd really like to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to come here and make the left, make Milo's point that the left is intolerant. And they weren't even able to vocalize. They just kind of made these weird grunting sounds back to me. I mean, this is how they're not even able to form rational arguments or say anything. They, you know, they just want to go cry and you know, ask for a safe space, and you know, and they claim like you know, like if Milo speaks on a campus, you know, like these, you'll get these gay men claiming that Milo made them feel so endangered as gay men that they felt fear walking to their car. I mean, I'm just like, you know, it's just become so irrational on the left that we need someone to be humor. And I'm actually quite jealous of Milo because, you know, if I were coming of age at this time, I think I could have done what Milo did and you know, attack the left with humor. But, but you know, I'm old and bitter now.
Getting back to that, first of all, I'll just throw out there that I agree on some of the issues in terms of it being absolutely crazy with people not being willing to hear the other side and listen to them and treat the other side with respect, and as opposed to somebody says something you disagree with, therefore you have to sort of shut them down. And I do agree with that sort of thing, but I wonder, you're ascribing a lot of this to the left. I sort of see it really, it seems like both sides of the political spectrum are getting increasingly, isolated in their own bubbles and have a really hard time even imagining where the other side comes from. And it's like, it's not a, you know, healthy disagreement of views that can be argued. It's more the other side is completely alien. I can't even comprehend where they're coming from. They must be evil. And it seems like that goes in both directions.
I disagree. I think that conservatives overall can tell you what the leftist arguments are, can actually state them pretty clearly. And I mean, I'm not saying all. I mean, but the most involved conservatives can actually, could, without any coaching, pretend to be liberals and do a good job of it. I do not think that the left could do the same thing. I do not think that, that they could make a convincing display of being conservative.
That would be an interesting test. I'm not as confident as you that either side could pull that off convincingly if you picked sort of random people off the street. Now, if meanwhile, if you pick sort of people who are intelligent and thoughtful on either side, I think they could do it. But it would be an interesting experiment. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Going back, and I sort of took us on a tangent there for a little bit, but just going back to sort of the interesting changes in the gay Republican world, aside from sort of the, you know, being open to somebody like Milo, are there other things that you wanted to highlight from there?
Well, the other things are, this is kind of problematic, but it's true that all the big gay Republican funders, or all the big Republican funders are pro-gay. I mean, like, almost every very last one of them. And so you have another example of kind of the elite versus, average Republican voter.
Well, and I think that is a pattern that you see. Like, if you look at the elite funder-type Republicans, they tend to be the economic type Republicans or the neoconservative type on foreign policy, and not the social conservative types who you do have that division. I think you're right to a large degree. I mean, certainly there are social conservatives who do some funding as well, but when you think of the big names, they are tend to be either economic or foreign policy conservatives much more than social conservatives.
And I mean, I guess not, gay marriage has happened is kind of a moot point, but one thing that I noticed, and I have no proof of this, but it just seemed to me from the reading, that the anger of the Republican base against Republican elites tended to be more on, issues like immigration and economic issues, that they really didn't bring up the base versus elite divide on gay issues that much.
Okay. Anything else to point out before we wrap it up?
Well, there is one tangent that I think is interesting, and maybe this doesn't even belong here. I don't know. I won't even say it. It's too tangential. We'll end there.
Now you've tantalized everybody. What's the tangent?
Well, it's about Black Lives Matter, and it does actually end up tying into this. I thought for a long time that when I first heard Black Lives Matter, I just assumed it was like black thugs wanting to, beat up old women and rape their girlfriends, and that's why they were saying the Black Lives Matter. And
really, course, Michael?
That was totally wrong.
Okay.
That was totally wrong. It turned out that, in fact, once I started looking at them and meeting them, I realized it was actually mostly gay people doing it, and mostly lesbians doing it. And I think it's, the same people who brought us the nonsense that one in four women is raped and all that type of feminist garbage are telling us this stuff about Black Lives Matter. And I thought, well, maybe this is just me thinking this. And it turns out Milo thinks the same thing. I came totally independently from him. And I'm thinking, there might be a tendency by gays to be a little more extreme politically than other groups.
Okay, so your hypothesis is just is that somehow along with the gay experience is a tendency to not be middle of the road, you might be very conservative, you might be very liberal, but you're not going to be middle of the road? Is that your hypothesis?
Well, I think there could be a lot of middle of the road people. I'm just saying that the people attracted to the extremes could very well be gays. Sometimes, and I don't know that that's a problem, but I just think that, you know, I think it's about myself and Milo, because I mean, in different ways, Milo and I are pretty extreme, and you know, I look at Black Lives Matter and I see another group of people that are pretty extreme about other issues, and I'm just wondering, maybe there is this tendency of gays to be a little more, some gays, quite certainly a minority of them, to be a little more extreme.
I have no idea, and whether or not, you know, any sort of sociological studies would back that up or not, but I suspect that you'd find, you know, it just a relatively even distribution throughout and not really have that excess tendency there. It's just that, you know, you notice the people who are vocal. The people who aren't vocal, you don't notice. And I think that, you know, sort of it changes what your impressions of those kinds of things are. You notice the people who are vocal, you notice the people who are like you, the rest are sort of invisible unless you do something really systematic to study it. That would be my guess, but who knows? You could be right. I don't think it's been studied. Might be interesting to do.
I think it would be interesting. I mean, and I don't think it's any negative thing about gay people if a minority of them tend to be more extreme. I mean, a lot of times, a lot of ideas do come from there, the extremes.
Yep. Okay, well, I think we should wrap it up here. So thank you for once again joining us, Michael, and we'll talk again another time, I guess. But it's once again interesting to talk to you because, I mean, I'll just, you know, from my point of view, you know, you're the set of positions that you have are very, very different than what I usually hear from people. And you're an interesting mix that's not what you would expect from either the Republican or the Democratic side. So it's always interesting to talk to you.
Okay. Well, you have a good night.
Okay. Thank you, Michael. Goodbye.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. And that's it from Michael. It's always a little strange to talk to Michael, to be honest. It's just, I never quite know what to think of what he has to say, but it's always interesting. Yvonne wasn't sure having him on again was even going to be interesting or helpful. I hope that it was interesting and you get some insight out of his perspectives, even though, like I said, at the end of the conversation with him, it's not really quite in line with probably anybody other than him. But it's still interesting to see. You can hear my son in the background here. I think it's time to wrap up the show. Once again, everybody, thank you for listening. Thank you for, especially, again, those of you who have been with us all 9 years and really listened to all these shows, thank you very, very much. That's amazing. For those of you who've joined us anytime along the line over the last few years or even in the last few months, thanks, and we hope you enjoy the show. Go to Facebook and like us if you haven't already. We're there at Curmudgeon's Corner. And go there to comment on the episodes and tell us what you think and suggest topics and all of that lovely sort of stuff. We love hearing from you. And, of course, if you like the show, tell your friends to listen, too. That's always good. But it's time to say goodbye. Alex, do you want to help say goodbye? Alex doesn't want to help say goodbye this time. So, there you go. Goodbye, everybody. Have a great week. We'll see you next time. Or hear you. Or no, we won't hear you. You'll hear us. You'll hear us again next time. Goodbye.